the cry of Washington. Live the lungs together with a rah, 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 and all the land.
Don James, Sonny Six Killer, the boys in the boat. Those are just some of the sports figures, and there are women, too, in the Husky Hall of Fame at the University of Washington. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell heard this week from a Seattle man who is working to get his grandfather inducted into this elite group, but who is not having much luck. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Is this another crusade, Felix?
No. I'm merely the conduit here for this story. Okay. The man who called me is Scott Grimm. His grandfather is one of the Grimm brothers. No, not those Grimm brothers. These are three guys from Centralia who played football for Washington beginning back in 1907. That's when Teddy Roosevelt was president, before the team was even called the Huskies. And this was during the time when a coach named Gil Dobie was in charge of the 40-game winning streak that went on in those years. Two of the Grimm brothers, Bill and Warren, were decent football players, but Scott's grandfather, Huber Grimm, nicknamed Polly, was great, and he was a multi-sport athlete. As a tackle for the football team, he was Washington's first All-American, the first All-American west of the Mississippi, and something of a real standout more than 110 years ago. And that's part of the problem, says Scott Grimm, since the Hall of Fame was only created in 1979.
So I think he's a faint memory in the minds of football aficionados at the University of Washington. He belongs in the Hall of Fame, clearly based on all his exploits in other sports as well. Being the U.S. wrestling champion in 1911, and also being a baseball player for the University of Washington, a trackster, and also wrestled for the University of Washington as a club sport.
So the guy did it all. And then after his college career, Polly Grimm was a pro wrestler back in the teens when pro wrestling wasn't quite yet a dramatic art. He also earned a law degree in his time at the UW and spent 30 years as a judge back in his hometown of Centralia, and he passed away in the late 1950s. But before we go any further, how exactly does a guy named Huber wind up getting called Polly?
When he was a child, he was in a play, and he was Polyphemus, the Cyclops, the one-eyed Cyclops, in the play. And they nicknamed him Polly, and it stuck. And he had that name all his life. Isn't that funny how that kind of stuff happens?
So the Husky Hall of Fame is managed by the Tyee Club, those boosters at the UW. There's a display in the lobby area of Heckhead Pavilion with a lot of plaques and things. Scott Grimm and his family are dyed-in-the-purple-and-gold-wool Husky fans. The family's been boating to games since 1954. This past year, Scott made time to put together a nomination packet to try and get his grandfather, Polly Grimm, in the Hall of Fame. They submitted the application last May, but then, well,
crickets. Crickets. Not a word. We didn't even get a thank you for your application. I have confirmed that it was there. You know, I had a nice conversation with the secretary or the assistant or whoever, administrative assistant. But that was about it. And then never heard anything until all of a sudden I saw on Twitter the announcement of those people.
And those people inducted at homecoming last October include football players like Marcus Tuasosopo and Jake Locker, tennis player Claire Carter, softball player Christian Rivera, and the group called the Five Who Dare. That was four black players and a coach who led a protest against racial discrimination back in 1969. So, a pretty distinguished group. Now, the guy in charge of the Hall of Fame and the nomination process is Jeff Bechtold. He's assistant athletic director for athletic communications at the UW. He's not sure why Scott Grimm didn't get notified. He's going to look into that. But he says there were a lot of nominations for this cycle. Jeff Bechtold also told me that, like other sports honors, the Husky version is very selective about who gets inducted.
I would say this. You know, to be respectful as possible, there are a lot of people who could have a very good argument that they belong in this Hall of Fame or that Hall of Fame. Those arguments exist about the Pro Football Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame, you name it, right? It's a very, very high bar. I would say also this, you know, in the early years, most of the early history of Husky sports was put into the Hall of Fame. The people from the 1900s through the 1930s or so were almost exclusively, you know, put in those first, say, 8 to 10 classes of the Husky Hall of Fame back in the 70s and into the 80s. Teammates of Polly's like Wee Coyle and his coach were both in the first two classes. So, you know, it's a high bar, and it's, you know, trying to be as respectful as possible. We get a lot of nominations. Last time, I think we got something like 50. Only 8 got in. We've kind of covered the early portion of the history of UW athletics through those first, say, 10 or so classes, and we have a lot of deserving people that deserve to get in, and it's very, very difficult. It's hard to tell people no, but, you know, that's the nature of this kind of thing.
So, I mean, I appreciate Jeff Bechtold's candor. I asked him about Polly Grimm's chances, see, a year from now, if Scott Grimm kind of keeps up a campaign. And Jeff Bechtold wasn't exactly encouraging. But meanwhile, Scott Grimm and his family aren't ready to give up just yet.
the world to us, because it what it does is it recognizes an accomplishment by a very accomplished man. He helped put the University of Washington on the map. People deserve to hear and understand what he did, just as much as any of the modern day athletes have helped the University of Washington.
Now, there's one more fascinating aspect of the history of the Grimm brothers. This is really a distinguished family in Washington history. Pauly Grimm is Scott's grandfather. That's who he wants in the Hall of Fame. Pauly's younger brother, Warren Grimm, his nickname was Wedge. He was a UW football player who also fought in World War I. He's already an indelible part of Centralia history, Washington history, and really American history.
Warren came back after the war and was in the front of the parade leading the Veterans Day parade, and he was shot by some IWW guys. So he was one of four guys that were murdered on in the streets of Centralia.
Yikes.
Yeah, and that's the Centralia Massacre of Armistice Day 1919, when there'd been labor trouble brewing in Centralia for many years. There'd been clashes between the IWW, the International Workers of the World, and Warren Wedge was part of the American Legion. He'd recently returned from overseas, and he was in this parade. And they think the IWW guys were who fired first, but Warren was one of four people who died on that side. One of the IWW guys was also beaten to death and then lynched outside Centralia there by the river. So all this history, I mean, it's not just sports history. It's not just political history or history of, you know, violence of 100 years ago. It's just this. It's all tied together. That's what I love about this story. I don't know if the Grimm family has much of a chance of getting their grandfather into the Hall of Fame. It seems like, based on what Jeff Bechtold is saying, that they pretty well think they've covered the early years, you know, in those early decades before they were even the Huskies. Like, they've covered that very well. So, I don't know. And like with Edgar Martinez and stuff, there's always these campaigns behind trying to get certain people into the Hall of Fame. I don't know if that will work in this case. It's really hard to say. I don't think they have enough experience and know. I don't think there's been too many public campaigns to get people in the Hall of Fame.
When's the next vote by the committee that decides these things?
They can submit nominations again, I think, starting late this year, and the committee will look again in 2023. They used to do it every year. They do it now every 2 years.
All right. Felix Bunnell, all of his features are available at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:47, Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's see if there's going to be a war in Europe anytime soon. Here's Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. And so there are 100,000 troops still massed on the Russia-Ukraine border. Vladimir Putin says not to worry about it. I guess they're just on some kind of camping trip. There were 4 hours of talks in Brussels. So who is offering what in exchange for what here?
Well, tell you the truth, Dave, right now the Russians seem to be pretty much stonewalling this. It's curious that they presented actually two draft treaties at the very beginning, sort of negotiating publicly, which is kind of unprecedented. Their demands seem to be, in essence, three things. One, Ukraine never being allowed to enter NATO. Two, that the United States forswears any deployment of missiles that might strike Russia from European territory and moves all nuclear weapons from Europe. And number three, that we roll back NATO infrastructure from any place or troops in any place it was no later than 1997, which would mean NATO infrastructure and troops positioned today in Poland, Baltic Republics, Romania, Bulgaria would have to be removed. Now, those are all kind of non-starters. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, the United States, in their discussions the other day, suggests that we might talk about reviving the INF Treaty, which did put limits on positioning missiles. We might talk about transparency measures and arms control agreements we've had in the past that would give Russians greater transparency on our troop movements and exercises and hopefully assuage some of their security concerns. I think it all boils down to, frankly, Dave, is this whole week of negotiations a pretext so Putin can say, well, I tried and it didn't work, and then conduct an invasion, or is he actually looking for an off-ramp where he can claim some successes to the Russian people and move towards more diplomatic solution?
Yeah, that's the question. Does he want a deal or does he want Ukraine? It seems to me if he actually goes ahead and invades Ukraine, he will basically have a never-ending guerrilla war, right? Because there's a lot of people there who would just not accept that, and they'd start a resistance.
Yeah, you could definitely say that this has backfired on him, and which you can read from the opinions of people in Ukraine are much more nationalistic, much more anti-Russian than they ever have been before. But, of course, it also depends on what portion of the Ukraine he invades. He could invade right now by the positioning of his forces from three directions, the north, the East as well as the South, he could try to swallow the whole country. I think that's probably more than he can chew right now for the reasons you just described. That being said, could he do a limited invasion, take over those particular provinces on the East where a civil war has been going on, which are largely populated by people who are Russian, and perhaps also secure a strip of land along the Sea of Azov, which would make the geography work between Russia proper and the Crimea, which is kind of separated now from Russia proper over a narrow bridge across the straits there, and make that work and just do a limited invasion, show that NATO was somewhat feckless in its response, undermine the Ukrainian government in Kiev and hopefully topple that, and bring on a government in Ukraine that would be neutralized, sort of Finlandized, and much more subservient to Moscow.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Finland is a stable country and people live normal lives there. But I mean, if that was allowed, that Russia gobble up the Russian part, wouldn't that be compared to Czechoslovakia in 1939, just the first domino to fall?
Exactly right. I mean, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind, Dave, is this whole crisis in the Ukraine, to me, is part of a longer-term strategy of Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation, going all the way back to 2004, when Putin said the end of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. Well, he might think that. I think World War II and World War I were pretty bad myself. But in any event, ever since then, I think his strategy has been to resurrect, at least in part, the Soviet Union, or at least Russian domination over those areas that were part and parcel of the Soviet Union. And so what have we seen? We've seen hybrid warfare. We've seen cyber attacks. We've seen them messing with elections in Europe, as well as, of course, the United States. We've seen them interfering in Brexit. We've seen them conducting assassinations. And we've seen them invade Ukraine back in 2014 and take the Crimea. All those to undermine liberal democracy in the West, undermine the credibility of the United States, and drive a wedge between the United States and its NATO allies, again, towards that longer strategy that she is trying to effect.
Okay, but wouldn't this be a pretty costly thing for him to do at a time when Russia's economy, I mean, as I understand it, isn't Russia's economy really small? They got nuclear weapons, but economically, they're nowhere near China. Are they anywhere near California? I mean, how big is their economy now?
John McCain used to describe Russia as a gas station with nuclear weapons, which is basically what it is. I mean, it is an extraction economy. Its number one item it sells, of course, is natural gas and oil. Nobody buys Russian cars. I'm sure you don't own a Russian computer or Russian shoes or anything like that. They don't produce anything that anybody really wants to buy outside of oil and natural gas. As a consequence, the Russian economy is about the size of Italy. That being said, they're able to focus their economy pretty directly into a lot of military things, and as a consequence, they have a pretty, without a question, daunting military. But you're right. I mean, Putin is doing tactics when he really needs to do strategy. Long-term, the Russian economy has enormous problems in terms of recapitalization, those energy parses, which are so important to him. It is the only industrialized society I know of in which the life expectancy of males is actually going down. It has huge climate problems, particularly out in Siberia. The COVID pandemic is raging in Russia right now, far worse in many ways, and we don't hear about it than it is in other parts of the world. And all those things are longer term things that he is ignoring while he is focused on this whole question of the, you know, concern about U.S. military forces being in Ukraine, which right now count up to 150. So he's worried about 150 Americans right now in Ukraine. He's going to position 100,000 Russian troops to secure Russia from that amazing threat.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Dave.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. More good-feeling stories are coming out of that. Remember that Interstate 95 in Virginia where so many drivers were stranded for hours? Well, an Uber driver was among those drivers stranded on that portion of I-95.
I was excited because I went out there to make money. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be a long ride. This is going to be a good fare. No problem. However, it turned into a nightmare, but a good nightmare. And that's weird to say, but I was just like, okay, at this point, it's not about the money. Let's figure out how to get us home.
Devontae Williams tells Fox 5 News in New York he sat for 5.5 hours in his vehicle overnight with a teenage passenger. Well, now he's being praised for his determination to get his young rider home safe. Williams said he had drinks and some snacks in his car and that his vehicle was good on gas, but he did start to get concerned about fuel as the clock ticked.
She would call her mother or call her father here and there to communicate what was going on. Then she would call a friend and say, I want to talk to you as long as I can. I'm just exhausted. I want to go to sleep. She was overwhelmed, and I totally understood because, again, all she wanted to do was get home.
So Williams did what he could. This Uber driver booked a hotel room for the rider to get some sleep, make alternative travel plans once they were unlocked from the gridlock. He even offered to drive her the rest of the way home once the roads were clear at no charge. Ultimately, a family friend was able to pick her up and get her home safely. But an Uber representative did later call Williams, hearing about this story, thanked him as one of their drivers asked for the receipt for the hotel room for reimbursement, though. Maybe Uber can do him one better for all that above and beyond work. Yeah. Still nice.
I guess that's a 5-star driver there. Huh?
Yeah, hopefully he gets a good review. Yeah, and a good tip.
And now at 7:48, direct from the Gene Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. I was just reading the report on Geno Smith, backup quarterback, apparently driving in an irresponsible manner, getting arrested, then lipping off to a police officer, allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you know about this?
I know that wasn't very smart on all ends of it. The fact that he got the DUI, and then also the second part of lipping off to the police officer. It's just terrible. Coming on the heels of which was a good day for the Seattle Seahawks. I want to remind everybody the Seahawks are 2-0 in the year 2022. Colleen, thank you. But this is absolutely terrible. What bothered me was his statement that he had put out there before. Mm. He is saying, like, hey, you know, try not to judge. You don't never know what someone's going through, all of those things.
Sure.
Dear Geno Smith, it is a global pandemic in this world right now. Guess what, buddy? We're all going through some things.
Right.
All of us are having a hard time.
Also, it's missing accountability, right? Like, we can have compassion for somebody who struggles with alcohol or drugs or mental health, but you also have to hold yourself accountable. Like, I'm going through things. I drove drunk, or if he wants to fight it, whatever. Give yourself compassion. I'm having a hard time, but accountable, I'm going to pay for my actions. Kind of like Mark Few. I feel like Mark Few is the only example of a public figure with a DUI who did the right thing.
Exactly. He did. I got to give Mark Few that. He listened, did what he was supposed to do, owned up to what he had done with his accountability of that. But again, I have a bad taste in my mouth with this. Now, look, every day people go out there and unfortunately they drink and drive. I think you just shouldn't do that at all. And usually most people don't get in the news and the media. But when you are a public figure, that's what's going to happen. And in this case, you're driving 96 miles per hour on the freeway. You come up on the cop in your two-door 2017 Rolls Royce. And life is rough, I guess. And so I don't feel sorry for him at all. As a matter of fact, I'm actually disappointed and Geno Smith. I'm disappointed in especially the next part of it with the mouthing off to the police officer that's alleged to have been done. I'm just disappointed about the whole thing. So, Dave, I'll simplify it. I'm very disappointed in Geno Smith, and I also believe that this action is going to cost him more money than just what a normal possible DUI be, whatever it gets pled down to, whatever the case. I think that this mistake is going to cost him more money down the road. Because sometimes the way players leave the game, right? And I don't know if this is his last hurrah. I have no idea about that. But what ends up happening is how you leave the game, that's the last thing you think about. So for an example, when Seattle fans, let's just say this is his last year in Seattle. Let's just say that it is. The last thing Seattle people will remember about Geno Smith is what? This right here.
Oh, yeah.
right here. This would be the last thing. You won't think about the fact that, oh man, Geno Smith was just doing well, and then Russell Wilson came back, but I kind of think Geno Smith should have stayed the starter. You're not going to be having that conversation no more. You forgot about that. You will now be thinking about this, and this is the part where I am.
But you also made the point that the quarterback is a special position in the NFL.
I know it.
There's a higher standard. You've got to be available. You can't be the kind of person who you don't know whether they're going to be there or be in jail from day to day.
You're the face. You are the face. Backup or starter, you are the face of the NFL franchise. Yes.
What's typically the fate of a backup quarterback? Because I'd also see, you know, if I was Geno, an opportunity with all this talk of, you know, Russell trade and all that. I'd go, hey, I'm going to sit tight and see if my opportunity is going to come in all this mess. It's unfortunate. I feel bad. I hope he gets the help he needs.
I really do too. But
he's got two prior DUIs too, right? So this sounds like a pattern and a chronic issue for him.
Excuse me, teacher. Huh? Let me raise my hand. Yeah. He does? I didn't even know that.
Well, let me see. That's what it said in my.
Oh, okay. Maybe it does. I don't know. I didn't.
Let me look it up.
It.
I want to make sure I get this right because we're talking about a man's reputation here.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, really quick. I know that I only got.
Yeah. Sorry about that. He has at least two other DUI arrests in the past. So maybe not convictions, but arrests.
Well, again, I have disappointment for him. And I'm sure I think that he, in this case, not only did he let himself down, but he let the Seattle Seahawks down because, again, Seattle comes off a great win. They're ending the season. We all know that they had a rough season. They played below expectations as far as wins, losses. They'll even say that themselves. And then everything is good. He had a great win down in Arizona. They come back and bam.
Yeah.
Now this, we're not just talking about, oh my goodness, Rashad Penny and Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll, everything's great. Now we're talking about, oh, by the way, but did you hear about Geno Smith, the backup quarterback?
Yeah.
Man.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo. Thank you, G.
Yes.
Good to have you with us this morning. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, Chris Sullivan. One of the big priorities for lawmakers and the governor to fix and clarify the state's new police reform laws. And here's Cairo's News Radio's Hannah Scott with some of the highlights. They're going to get it right this time. Is that my understanding?
That is the hope. But it's going to be a lot of work and in a short session, as yesterday's hearing in the House Public Safety Committee will show. First off, I got a chance to talk to the chair of that committee, Roger Goodman, ahead of yesterday's public hearing on a trio of these bills. And he explained what the goal is as far as what they're trying to fix.
We are going to be adjusting the policing laws. We're going to make sure that police know that they can attend to mental health crisis, that they can protect kids who are being abused or who are runaways, that they can serve court orders, do all the things that police do, helping fire and EMS on a scene and render life-saving measures. Although we didn't amend any other statutes, it wasn't clear that to police that they could continue to physically engage with people. We call it use of force, but it's not violent. It's actually physically, you know, touching people to help them, not to hurt them. So we're going to fix that.
That has to do with the involuntary treatment calls, mental health calls that have been in question now since these bills passed last year. There's also questions surrounding use of force in criminal issues.
And we're going to expand the ability for police to use force in criminal matters when there's only reasonable suspicion and not probable cause. Probable cause is a high threshold sometimes when they don't really have enough information to know who did what. And so we want police to be able, again, to physically interact with people, but physically restrain them, prevent them from fleeing when they're investigating a crime before they've reached probable cause. And we want to focus on the serious crimes, violent offenses, sex offenses, assault, and domestic violence. Domestic violence is my major concern.
So what they've done is split that fix into two separate bills, one to address the use of force when it comes to police responding to help a mental health professional in an involuntary treatment situation, and then another bill to define use of force when it comes to criminal issues. Specifically, it lowers that probable cause threshold that they made last year to reasonable care, like you said, specifically when we're talking about a rape, a violent assault, domestic violence, that kind of thing. But the James McMahon, who's with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, says the language in this fix is just not going to work.
These issues are necessary for the legislature to address, but the language in this bill does not sufficiently address them for our officers to provide the level of public safety that our communities expect and deserve. I'll reiterate and repeat, or just allude to my comments in the previous bill about the definition of physical force, but I want to specifically get into the complexities that the language has proposed, especially about the Terry stop language in this bill. It's simply not realistic for officers to be able to abide by correctly and appropriately in the field. We're relying on officers to know definitions of definitions of definitions here, and they have to get it right. The consequences for using excessive force are dire.
Of course.
So explain the Terry stop, please.
A Terry stop is when you are, I believe, if you're stopping somebody based on suspicion of them being involved in some sort of crime. And I think a lot of
you haven't actually seen the crime, but right. You have a reason to stop the person.
Right. A reason to stop the person. And that was a very big issue for the families that pushed for these changes. And the definition here in these stops, he says, are just not, they're not clear enough. And because the definitions of what constitutes that ability to stop, basically.
So what I'm hearing from him is he doesn't think these fixes are going to solve the crisis that the police believe they are in.
Not at the moment. And again, so this is the beginning of a 60-day session. It's short, and this is a top priority.
But let me ask you what the politics are in this now. Is this the kind of thing where Republicans and Democrats are working together to try and come to something that works? Or is this being controlled, frankly, by pressure groups on the outside?
There is a lot of bipartisan effort to get these right. There are some different bills on the part of Republicans who put out a 45-46-some-odd bill public safety plan of their own. Some lawmakers on the Republican side want to repeal, straight up repeal, some of the laws that were passed on policing last year. But then you have some who are more cooperative, who want to work together, who want to make sure that at least something gets done and that it helps police understand what they can and cannot do. So that is my sense, is that we will get something that you get a compromise, I think, hopefully, on all sides. But again, early, and what's clear in this is that the language in that bill regarding criminal use of force in a criminal situation is so not clear right now. McMahon went on to explain that.
Violent offenses does not include all things that are violent. Assault offense does not include all things that constitute assault. Custodial assault, vehicular assault do not fall within either of those definitions. If a person strikes me with their fist, it does fall here. If they strike me with a vehicle, it's not included in any of these. Residential burglary is not included. Bomb threats aren't included. Hate crimes aren't included. We need very clear and concise, understandable rules. We'd love to be part of that conversation. Again, we think these changes are necessary. The language is not sufficient.
And there were also issues with the one that has to do with the mental health providers in responding. And actually, this woman, she's a mother. This was a heartbreaking story. She shared her story about what happened when police didn't respond in because of these new laws.
We have been dealing with all this since October 24th. That is when my son went into a full-blown psychotic episode with paranoia, delusions, and hallucinations. The police in each city refused to take him against his will to the hospital and said he would have to commit a crime in order to get medical treatment. Eventually, that is exactly what happened. Because of this, he was forced into 25 days of homelessness in severe weather. He was arrested once in Bellevue on December 3rd and once in Des Moines on January 4th. The second charge, January 4th, was for domestic violence in the fourth degree against me, his mother. This 13-hand bill has devastated our family emotionally, physically, and mentally in so many ways. There needs to be 100% clarification of the use of force for mental health crisis situations so the police can provide any help, if necessary, with force to crisis responders to detain someone in a mental health crisis to a medical facility.
Heartbreaking. And the crisis responders also having issues.
But over the past 6 months, we have heard from our providers all across the state tragic stories of individuals not getting the help they need and of staff being unable to safely do their jobs. When police do not respond to or assist a designated crisis responder in ensuring a safe transport to a behavioral health facility or hospital, the result is that people in crisis are being abandoned in our communities without any type of treatment or intervention.
So that That is a terrifying situation. That's what leads to, you know, random attacks on people, all kinds of different things.
So in the face of testimony like this, are there still people who say, no, no, we don't want police to show up with mental health workers?
No, and I don't know that you see, you know, I think that was part of a conversation during the, like, the defund movement. But there are people who say you don't want just police to respond to those type of calls. You want them to come together. The crisis responders, they don't want to be out there on their own. That's a problem.
Right.
And then obviously there's so many different legs to this, what the implications are. The overall sense here is that everyone agrees we need to be able to clarify these bills and make sure that these things are being so the cops know exactly what they're doing, exactly what they're allowed to do, what kind of force is allowed, so that there is no question in their mind when they have to make a split second decision what it is that they are free to do under the laws of the state.
It's just that this began with the police, with cops jacking up innocent people, right
exactly,
and not being punished for it,
and people being shot and killed and their family members saying,
and not being punished for it. I mean, we now see there have been several court cases where cops have indeed been punished for this, so at least we're moving on.
I don't know about several, a couple, but okay.
I'm not, you know, there's still more to do there, but how did it get to the point where now you can't basically save a mentally ill person from himself?
A error in the language of a bill, a bill that went through, you know, some will say very quickly, and stuff falling through the cracks. It is not uncommon for fix bills needed to, but the results of the fix needed for these particular bills, for not getting it right the first time on these types of bills with police, is devastating. It's got so many implications, and it's causing a ripple effect all over the state. I just want to make sure that I do hit the fact that there are also family members who pushed to get all of these laws changed last year, who are, you know, they don't like the stories of, like, the mother who got hit, all of that. That was never their intention. They want their loved ones not to get shot and killed by police. And they are upset with the reasonable care standard, or the, you know, probable cause standard being lowered to reasonable care, because they say that was the issue in the first place.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And it's time to analyze the New York Times 2022 food forecast. And Rachel Bell, being the director of the Cairo Test Kitchen, is the perfect person to enlist for this.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of throwaway articles, things like the best of last year and what's happening this year. And usually I get kind of bored with them. But this one I thought was particularly interesting because the food trends seem to be shifting towards wellness in some ways, and, you know, making our brains work better instead of just like, next year it's going to be a pizza, hot dog, burrito rolled up in a frozen waffle. So I thought it was interesting to talk about these and to see how many of these things exist or are coming to Seattle, because we are pretty far behind New York and LA in a lot of ways, I think, especially in fashion, but also in food. So the ingredient of the year that they name is mushrooms.
Mushrooms.
And I believe them because people are getting really into mushrooms, not just, you know, for eating dinner, but also for microdosing, for mental health, and also for something. Do you know what adaptogenic means, if something has adaptogenic properties?
No.
Basically, there are certain plants and mushrooms that have properties in them that are supposed to make you less stressed out.
Oh.
And again, I don't know how many you have to eat for this to happen. You know, it's kind of like they talk about, you know, turmeric being really good for you, but maybe you have to have a bathtub full for it to work. But mushrooms are being used in all different ways. They talk about in the article, like, if you wanted to go plant-based, instead of having a scallop, you might carve an oyster mushroom in the shape of a scallop and use it as a substitute. But the adaptogenic thing is becoming more popular. And I love these drinks. Here in Seattle, we have a couple places that make a drink that I like that has beetroot powder, coconut milk, cinnamon, ginger, and ashwagandha root. And it's like this bright pink, super creamy, sweet drink that doesn't taste like beets, and it's supposed to make me less stressed.
I see. And does it work?
I don't know if it works, but I love the taste, and I've turned so many friends onto it. So if you're listening and you want to try it, I know two places that have a couple different adaptogenic drinks. Some use turmeric, like turmeric lattes, Miro tea, and a really cool place called Sabine in Ballard. One more thing about mushrooms, and I actually want to do a whole feature on this, but the owner of Cupcake Royale, her name's Jody Hall. She has since opened an edibles business, so like edible marijuana. But her new business in Capitol Hill is called Wonderground, and it's blends of roasted coffee with mushrooms like lion's mane, chaga, reishi, and it's that whole idea of the adaptogenic properties.
What does that do for the coffee?
Well, I think it just is, you know, you're drinking coffee, but you're also getting these mushrooms that are supposed to be really good for you. And
so this is
brain,
a combination of food and medicine then. This is, we're using food to treat stress.
Exactly.
I thought that's what ice cream was for. That's why you eat a pint of ice cream, isn't it?
Yeah, now you have to sprinkle mushrooms on top.
I'll tell you what got me most excited on this list was the edible tableware. Including
that was
these,
my favorite, too.
See? It's these coffee cups, which are apparently made of, I don't know what they're made of, but after you, they're sturdy enough to hold the coffee, I guess, even while it's hot. But then after you finish the coffee, you can start taking a bite out of the cup and eat the cup.
Yeah. And they're doing everything from spoons to chopsticks, plates, bowls and cups. And the one I was looking at online, it seems like there's a lot of companies now. It's a company called Cupfy. Theirs is like an edible wafer. So I get the feeling from what I've read that they're kind of like cookies, but not super sweet. Mm-hmm. And they said that theirs will stay crunchy for 40 minutes. So you have 40 minutes to drink your coffee.
Yes. And if you don't, well, it's going to be in your lap.
That's right. But I think it'll probably be cool by 40 minutes anyway. So
at least it won't hurt you, right?
I haven't seen this around town. I would love to see this. I think that it's super cool because obviously we have been doing this for million, billion years with the ice cream cone.
Yeah, oh, like well, I mean, I've told you this before. I'm an expert on medieval dining strategies because I went to the Kamlan Medieval Fair twice, and they serve the food there on, you know, like flatbread, so that you don't have to have utensils at all.
Just like the pasties that are really popular in Michigan, it was something that the miners would eat because it's just like basically a calzone with more food inside, and the outside was kind of hard and gross. But it was just like a vehicle for carrying the good food inside other food.
So it sounds like the food future is bright between the edible cups and the medicinal drinks. My dad used to call his martini his medicine, but this sounds like it's a little healthier than that.
And then another one that's really cool is the trend they anticipate of Vietnamese coffee. And I was excited about that because we have a fantastic place in Seattle called Hello M-E-M. They're in Little Saigon in the International District. And it's owned by the owners of Pho Bach, which is Yen V Pham. And her parents started Pho Bach. It was the first pho restaurant in Seattle. She actually goes to Vietnam and sources the coffee herself and roasts it in their spot down in the ID. And they make really interesting drinks that I haven't had anywhere else. Interesting to me because I'd never had these, you know, different concoctions of Vietnamese lattes that are made with, in some cases, whipped raw egg white or like the egg yolk even to make it creamy, and they're sweet and delicious and their food is so good. So Hello M is a good place to try.
Sounds intriguing. It's always nice to have a fancy drink that doesn't make you drunk. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.